Are you looking to give your immune system a boost? This is Dr. Ronald Hoppen with a natural solution from Future Farm Botanicals, liquid wild oil of oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's wild oil of oregano supports a variety of health benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate wild oil of oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. Future Farm sources this product from the Mediterranean and produces it in the United States. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking about integrative gastroenterology with a rare commodity in medicine, which is an actual integrative gastroenterologist. Alexander Shastina is the only one of that kind in the big metropolitan area of New York City. And she, in part one, told us about her journey and some of her approaches. And in part two, I want to focus a little bit on some of the supplements that she likes to use, and also on inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's disease. So before we get to that, though, I've seen a lot of ads for something called EPI. And I never knew about EPI until I saw the ads. When I see ads about something, I always suspect an ulterior motive. A drug company is making something that they want to get out to the public. So they make people think like, oh, maybe I've got this disease and maybe I need to ask my doctor for something for it. The ads say, talk to your gastroenterologist about EPI. That is, if I am correct, exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. And, you know, we've used digestive enzymes for eons in integrative medicine. It seems like the drug companies want in on the action.
Right. So I mean, they're basically indicated for patients with, they're indicated in a conventional practice for patients with pancreatic insufficiency, usually from chronic pancreatitis. Mm-hmm. And they're really effective. They're actually, one of the safest and more effective treatments that we have. A lot of patients.
Because it's natural. We're giving people back natural, something that exactly. They don't produce. It's always the best kind of treatment. It's not an artificial drug, but just replacing something the body doesn't make enough of, like natural thyroid.
Exactly. It's exactly right. So when people have, severe exocrine pancreatic insufficiency from a chronic inflammatory state in their pancreas, anything that triggers the pancreas to work, which is food, pretty much, especially foods that are higher in fat, they cause a lot of pain. And then on top of that, the patients malabsorb and have fatty diarrhea. So giving them enzymes actually is like a pain reliever. It's really remarkably effective.
Do you ever find that patients short of a formal diagnosis of EPI, patients who've not had pancreatitis or pancreatic surgery, ordinary patients with IBS, that sometimes they respond to even, over-the-counter digestive enzymes?
Yes. I do occasionally use them for someone who doesn't have a diagnostic criteria to fulfill real exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. But and I have found that to be sometimes helpful for patients with similar, for like a pain that's not resolved, or especially in the context of loose stools.
So what are some of your other go-to supplements, the supplements that you favor in treating things like GERD or IBS or even ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease?
So I do use probiotics quite a bit. I tend to favor fermented foods over probiotics for patients who can eat raw, different kinds of raw vegetables like sauerkraut or kimchi or what have you. I find those to be a good source of it, because it provides both the prebiotic and the probiotic, and it's a more reliable source of the bacteria. Not everyone wants that, and not everyone can eat that. And so I do use probiotics quite a bit. And I think that's actually even a conventional recommendation for irritable bowel, because we already have an idea that it's associated with some type of dysbiosis. So that's one thing that I use quite a bit. For reflux, I talk a lot about dietary changes, but I don't use so many supplements for reflux, because I find reflux works very well, is very amenable to visceral manipulation, because the lower esophageal sphincter is typically the problem.
Yeah.
So the issue is actually not.
Chiropractors sometimes do that too. Chiropractors sometimes do an adjustment that opens that up or relaxes the spasm. I'm not sure what they do, but they press you right below the breastbone, and that's said to help.
So I find that to be actually one of the most easiest things to actually fix, if you will, for GERD, because GERD is not really an issue so much with high acid, but more of an issue of, from my experience, of the sphincter not being adequately closed at the time when it should be, meaning the stomach is a natural high acid organ that's equipped to handle the high acid and should have high acid, but the esophagus isn't. So the sphincter that connects the stomach and the esophagus needs to stay closed at times when food is not going down. And some of the symptoms that we see associated with GERD is when the acid where the stomach is well equipped to handle goes up into the esophagus, which is not equipped to handle that kind of acid, and that causes discomfort and inflammation. So by helping close that sphincter, that really relieves a lot of symptoms.
Speaking of inflammation of the esophagus, something that I've always been puzzled by is Barrett's esophagus. Barrett's esophagus is, as you can explain as well as I can, but it's thought to be a precancerous lesion of the esophagus, and it's sometimes an excuse to give people a lifetime of acid-blocking medication. Now, and it's very hard to deviate from that, because God forbid, on your watch, someone goes on to develop esophageal cancer, a fatal disease. You don't want to be the doctor who said, don't worry about it, don't take an acid blocker. But in your mind, do you feel that acid blockade is always de rigueur for a lifetime for these people?
So it's exactly right. It's a little bit scary to say don't take it and then have responsibility for someone, God forbid, developing cancer. The truth is Barrett is a precancerous.
Yeah, condition. Very, very only tiny percentage of people go on it. And I think I typically ask patients, well, what percentage of people with Barrett's esophagus go on to develop cancer? They typically give me double digit answers or high single digit answers. And what it turns out is it's a fraction of a percent that develop esophageal cancer. And I think people need education around that, because they've done a great selling job around this diagnosis of Barrett's esophagus, which has only arisen in the endoscopic era. We've only known about it since we've been able to look down there. And esophageal cancer, I don't think we're stemming the tide of esophageal cancer by giving tens of millions of people acid blockers.
I agree with you. I'm not sure that we're actually even preventing esophageal cancer. The premise behind it is that the chronic inflammation associated from the acid causes a metaplasia, or basically when cells from that are supposed to line the esophagus start to look like intestinal cells. And so that's actually the definition of Barrett's, is metaplasia. Metaplasia is two steps before cancer. It has first to go into dysplasia, I'm sure, as you know, where the cells go from looking to a different kind of cell to an abnormal cell, and then it's invasive. So it's really, it's not so closely associated with esophageal cancer. But the thought is if you prevent further inflammation, then those, then that metaplasia should not become dysplasia. I'm not sure that's ever been proven that that actually
I don't think
works.
They would allow that experiment in America because, right. you know, once they've demonstrated that it can progress to such a serious cancer, I think it'd be considered like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment to take people with this condition and not treat them. But maybe it should be investigated more thoroughly before we all jump on board with literally decades of acid blockade with other potential consequences when maybe a very tiny percentage of people would progress and there are natural ways to deal with it.
I agree. And honestly, I've seen it not very commonly, but I've seen it regress on its
own. Mm-hmm. Me too.
With
diet change, with certain supplements, anti-inflammatory supplements,
right.
you know, I give patients extract of green tea and curcumin and DGL, the licorice anti-inflammatory. And, you know, many patients, they go back for a subsequent endoscopy, and the doctor says, I can't see it anymore. It's like, what happened?
Right. You know? Right, exactly. And sometimes I've even seen it regress, you know, in my regular practice with no treatment. They just came back and they had another endoscopy. They didn't want to get the therapy and it regressed. So I think we're far from knowing really how effective these medications are and really what the association of Barrett's is to esophageal cancer.
What other supplements do you like for, well, let's focus a little bit on inflammatory bowel disease. I mean, clearly, there's a lot of people coming down with inflammatory bowel disease. What's really very, very disturbing is the number of children who we see with Crohn's disease, with ulcerative colitis. It's really disheartening. It suggests that maybe something about our lifestyles, our diets, is having an impact on a very, very severe lifetime digestive disorder.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's definitely growing, and it's even growing in places that we didn't used to see it so much, like in the Far East, for example, where they had a really low rates of inflammatory bowel disease, and now they're growing. And you know, the thought is that it's because of this of our diet. We're spreading it far and wide from the Western world to the Eastern world, where they used to eat a lot better than we did. But yes, it's really becoming a much more common diagnosis, and it can present very early in life in teenagers or children, or it can present as adults. It has a multi-age presentation, and it can vary very much in severity. Some people have just a small patch of biopsy proven Crohn's, and some people have massive pancolitis or strictures and fistulae and really severe Crohn's. So I think it's a very interesting disease, and it's really treated, in my opinion, inappropriately, based on the current medical guidelines. So we know that, that Crohn's and ulcerative colitis have an autoimmune component. So, the mainstay of treatment, especially for severe Crohn's and colitis, is really suppressing the immune system, mm-hmm. Which is typically a systemic treatment. So, you suppress the entire immune system. So, you're going to decrease the inflammatory response in the gut, but you're also going to suppress the immune system everywhere else. And they try to be a little more specific, and they're coming out in new medications, but they still really have systemic manifestations, and they have increased rates of different types mm-hmm. of cancers and infections, and I don't think they're as safe as they are sometimes thought to be.
Mm-hmm. And there's a trend, and I've noticed this in my relatively long medical career, is that these medications were sometimes used as a very, very last resort. In rheumatology, for example, for rheumatoid arthritis, or for psoriasis, or for MS. And now they're being invoked as, you have to do some early before damage is done.
Exactly, right.
And the thought is, these are very expensive drugs with a lot of side effects. And I've seen so much success in treating ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease with natural approaches. And now more and more people are speaking out about this. Are you on board with diet approaches and other approaches?
Absolutely. So that, some of the things that I speak to patients about is, definitely changing their diet. And it's amazing how little information some people have about it. You know, some basic things like eliminating dairy, which is even published, it's really not spoken about. So that's, I definitely discussed that. There are some good supplements. Patients with inflammatory bowel disease are deficient in vitamin D, which is part of probably the whole inflammatory process. And the thought is sometimes even to treat them at higher levels of a vitamin D in their blood to get them to a higher level than what just the lab value says is normal. Mm-hmm. And that helps the inflammatory state. Probiotics, actually have been studied fairly well in ulcerative colitis. So that is definitely another issue, and that also lends itself to the thought that there's a level of abnormal, the microbiome is altered in inflammatory bowel disease. So probiotics definitely have a role, especially in ulcerative colitis. A product that I recently started using for some of my patients, is bovine colostrum. Mm-hmm. So there is also a component that's been studied of inflammatory bowel disease, which is, increased intestinal permeability or leaky gut. Mm-hmm. So that is really targets that. And I've actually had some pretty good results with that for some of my very severe, patients with colitis. I frequently use, different Chinese herbal, combinations, which are not necessarily specifically for ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, but just generally anti-inflammatory and support elimination of the bad bugs. So we know that also there's some association of intestinal infections and abnormal pathogens in Crohn's and colitis, and especially in Crohn's. We know that one of the actually diagnostic features of Crohn's is an antibody towards yeast.
Mm-hmm,
So it's interesting.
Anti-Saccharomyces antibodies is a test that reveals the presence of Crohn's disease. And I'm wondering, why don't people pick up on that cue and consider a yeast-free diet, or certainly limiting sugar to prevent yeast overgrowth?
I know. It makes total sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. So this goes back to the yeast connection that we were talking about 30, 40 years ago.
Right. Exactly.
So some of these Chinese formulas, one of the common ingredients in those formulas that are helpful for inflammatory bowel disease is indigo. Indigo is known as the blue gene dye, right? It's the old dye that used to make things blue.
Yeah. But
it seems to have, it's part and parcel of several formulas that seem to have a soothing effect. And some studies suggest that indigo can be helpful in inflammatory bowel disease.
Interesting. I haven't used it, but I do use some other combinations, like marshmallow root, licorice root.
Yeah. All natural anti-inflammatories.
Right. Slippery elm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, in terms of, let's see where we're going from here, The diet that you prescribe for ulcerative colitis, one of the diets that has been recommended for this is something called the SCD, the specific carbohydrate diet. You just mentioned a component of the specific carbohydrate diet, which is dairy. They allow fermented dairy products. Do you use the SCD, or do you use a modified version of the SCD to treat Crohn's and colitis patients?
So... there's parts of SCD that is effective, probably for Crohn's and colitis, for many other issues. The fact that the sugar-free and the low starch and the grain-free. The problem I think when you prescribe a diet like that, and I've had patients come in, you know, well, I'm on the SCD diet, and these cookies are SCD approved, but right, they have a ton of preservatives.
Yeah.
So it's just like with every other trendy
phenomenon. It's like, you know, people try to capitalize on it, and you know, you get macrobiotic candies and paleo cookies, and you know,
exactly,
you kind of append the name to it, and it seems like it's wholesome.
Exactly. So there are definitely great things about that diet, but I think it's a very important to get quality ingredients, and maybe that might even be more important than what you're eating, but making sure that it's a good product.
Mm-hmm.
Not all SCD cookies are the same. You know, if you bake something at home, it's not the same thing as if you're getting it in a package. And so there are certain things about it that are good, and for dairy is one of those things, and gluten is one of those things. But certainly quality of products is highly important.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess the advantage, in seeing a physician like you, I mean, look, there are a lot of people out there, who treat gastrointestinal ailments, nutritionally oriented chiropractors, registered dietitians, naturopaths. But I think the advantage in seeing someone like you is you really understand the medications. You also understand the potential severity of some of these diseases. And if there's really a need for medication, you can prescribe it. You can also scope patients. That's part of your practice. If a patient needs to, you know, need to do a look-see, you can go down the esophagus or up the other end and see if indeed there's some, you know, something heavy duty going on. I think that that's really an ideal, combination. I don't know, maybe I've had it all over again. It seems that so much of my practice is oriented to gastroenterology. I might have, signed up for that extra 3 years of an arduous, GI fellowship. So at least I'd have the prerogative to scope patients and understand better how some of these complicated drugs work. And you have that ability.
Right. Thank you. Yeah. The truth is, I probably wouldn't have, if I was already thinking of that in this direction, I probably wouldn't have done a fellowship. So I guess it's a good thing I wasn't headed down that route before I signed up for GI.
Indeed. Yeah, and, you know, I think before you reject conventional therapies, I think you have to understand them and understand the place that they have in management of sometimes very ill patients.
Absolutely.
So I think, you know, you certainly have that advantage from extensive hospital experience and training. Give us some information about your practice. I gave the website, but you actually have a simpler name for your website now, right?
Yeah. So it's WholeGut, WHOLEGUT.com, and I am located on Broadway between 21st and 22nd Street, and you know, and we do it all. So I do endoscopy in an endoscopy center nearby, and you know, that's certainly not the bulk of my practice, and that's, you know, mm-hmm. we call it
sometimes disparagingly scoping for dollars, as you may be aware.
I am aware, and it is a large part of most gastroenterologists' mm-hmm. practice,
mm-hmm.
because it's a utilized tool,
yeah,
that, you know, hopefully usually appropriately utilized, but I guess unfortunately sometimes more than appropriately.
I just want to ask you another question, which
sure.
is, what's the lunchroom scuttlebutt when you gastroenterologists settle down to have lunch about the potential for gastroenterology to kind of go extinct? Because the concern is that, you know, non-invasive procedures like radiology procedures or you know, some of these new colon cancer screening techniques may render scoping virtually superfluous. I mean, yes, always there's a need sometimes for going up there and snaring a suspicious-looking polyp, but it may be that from the business standpoint, gastroenterologists, I know this is not your concern because you're more holistically oriented, but some gastroenterologists may be worried that, you know, maybe we won't be doing so much scoping in the latter part of the 21st century.
You know, we haven't discussed that. I've actually, if anything, seen a rise in endoscopy.
Okay.
And certainly there is now screening modalities for colorectal cancer that are non-invasive, but they really haven't yet become mainstream. Like, for example, CT colonography, which is mm-hmm. a special type of CAT scan that is used to detect polyps. So I don't think the technology has been used so much. And I think one of the issues is that it still requires a bowel prep. So if you're going
to
use a bowel prep,
you'll have to have air insufflated up your rear end anyway, right? So
exactly.
Might as well get a scope up there.
So that's one thought, because if they do see something, you're still going to need to have a colonoscopy, and then you're going to have to go through it twice. And that's usually mm-hmm. the worst part of it, is the bowel prep.
Yeah.
So the second thing is that it's, you need someone who is, who is trained in that particular modality. A standard, radiologist probably isn't good enough to mm-hmm. detect polyps. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the size of the polyps. So the polyps have to be a significant size, over 5 centimeters, I believe, to be detected on CT. So it's okay. I don't think we're at a place yet that we're afraid that these things are going to take over. And I haven't had, you know, most people aren't worried. I think most people are more worried about, issues of reimbursement, unfortunately, as that's really gone down significantly for endoscopy and for doctors for whom that is a large part of their practice. They're doing a very large volume to maintain right. that.
So they won't be driving Mercedes. They'll have to be driving Chevy Volts in the future. There won't be a time when they're out of business.
Well, I don't know. Probably there will be, because I think everything changes and everything is cyclical, and the fields that were so popular, at some time and are not so popular now. And I think that there's definitely going to be changes. But I just don't think that as a medical community, we think outside the box so much to say, hey, things are going to change. Let's do something differently. I think we're still kind of ingrained in, I've been trained for so many years in this way. What else am I going to do?
Exactly.
I'll just do more of it. And I think that's really been the thought process.
Double down. Well, look, thank goodness you're a pioneer in this field of integrative gastroenterology, and we commend you for taking the leap. And the hope is that 20 years hence, it'll be robust. And, unfortunately, you'll have a lot of competitors. I think that is destined to happen, because it's the right way to go, and you've embraced
exactly.
it.
Absolutely. We should, because I think there's really a growing demand for it, and people really need this kind of care.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Dr. Alexandra Shostina.
Thank you so much.
Give us the website once again, please.
It's www.wholegut, wholegut, like whole and gut, like intestine.com.
Thanks again. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. As an Intelligent Medicine listener, you know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. But vetting your sources and tracking down the exact products you need can be a hassle. That's why I'm inviting you to browse my online supplement dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. We stock only the highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements I prescribe to my patients and take myself. My specially curated professional-grade supplements are fulfilled via the FullScript network. FullScript is the safest and most convenient way to purchase my medical-grade supplements. Buying through FullScript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant, and offers world-class support. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com to sign up for your free FullScript account. That's drhoffmanstore.com, drhoffmanstore.com.